A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 13, Sparta Triumphant.
After the great Spartan victory in the Peloponnesian War, the Spartan commander Lysander worked to set up regimes favorable to Sparta, generally very narrow oligarchic regimes, favorable to Sparta, and indeed favorable particularly to Lysander himself, all over the Aegean basin, wherever he could. And shortly thereafter, in the year 400, King Agis II died. This led in Sparta to a fierce and influential succession dispute. The son of Agis II was a man by the name of Leotychidas or Latychidas, but there was some question about his birth. You remember that Alcibiades, the unscrupulous Athenian commander, at one point defected to Sparta and was indeed accused, evidently with good reason, of having an affair with King Agis's wife. And there was not only question about Latychidas's legitimacy as King Agis's son, there was some suspicion that he was in fact the son of Alcibiades, the brilliant but unscrupulous Athenian, who indeed is on record, whether truly or no, as having said that one reason that he had an affair with the wife of King Agis was so that his descendants might rule Sparta, a high ambition for an Athenian aristocrat, an unprecedented ambition, one might say, for an Athenian aristocrat. Because Latychidas had been the heir apparent in Sparta, his half-brother, Agesilaus II, had gone through the traditional Spartan upbringing, the agoge, from which only heirs apparent, royal heirs apparent, were exempted among citizen males. While he had gone through the agoge, young Agesilaus had been adopted as a beloved by his older pederastic lover, by none other than Lysander himself. And Lysander, who was now, though not king, the most powerful man probably not only in the Spartan world, but indeed this side of the great king of Persia himself and the whole East Mediterranean basin, Lysander began to argue that Agesilaus and not Latychidas, or Leotychidas, should be king of Sparta, and due to his influence, he prevailed, all the more so because there was an oracle outstanding which said Sparta would come to ruin under a lame king. Well, at first glance, this would have worked against the candidacy of Agesilaus, who, surprisingly for a Spartan, Spartan citizens, remember, were inspected at birth to see if they were whole and healthy, and if not, were disposed of, to put the matter gently. Agesilaus was to some degree lame. That had not prevented him from being spared. That had not prevented him from doing very, very well, summa cum laude, as Paul Cartledge puts it in the Agoge, but nonetheless, he was to some degree lame physically. Lysander, however, succeeded in persuading the powers that be in Sparta that what lame kingship meant was not the physical, at least partial, lameness of Agesilaus, but the lameness, metaphorically speaking, of illegitimacy. And hence, Agesilaus ascended to the throne, and Lysander thought that he was home free and would be able effectively to dominate Sparta and Spartan policy on that basis. Shortly thereafter, Almost immediately thereafter, the Spartans were very attentive to omens, and dreadful omens appeared in the auspices, as if Sparta were surrounded by mortal enemies. And what was unveiled in the ensuing weeks was a conspiracy by a demoted Spartan, or a person of Spartan background who, for one reason or another, was not a full citizen, by the name of Kinadon, who had been gathering together disaffected elements throughout the Spartan polity, helots, obviously, and of course, perioeci, various second-rank quasi-Spartan citizens or almost Spartan citizens, all of whom, we are told, according to the existing sources, wanted to eat the Spartans raw, if they could, which suggests a certain degree of hostility towards the Spartan powers that be. Well, they managed to squelch that conspiracy, alarming though it was. Meanwhile, Cyrus, if you will remember, the teenage son of the king of Persia, who had supported Sparta lavishly, so lavishly that his financial support, as much as any other factor, enabled Sparta to win the war, decided in 401 that after the death of his father, he, rather than his older brother, Artaxerxes, should ascend to the Persian throne. Indeed, it is certainly not impossible that, clever teenage lad that he was, his support of Sparta, which had been most generous all along, had been provided with a view towards assuring some Spartan help when he sought to depose his big brother. In any case, in 401, he made the attempt with 10,000 Greek mercenaries, among them the Athenian writer Xenophon, who provided an account, the anabasis of the expedition and its aftermath, and set off to the heart of the Persian Empire to depose his brother. And at the Battle of Cunaxa in 401, just outside Babylon, his forces won. Unfortunately for Cyrus, he was personally so eager to kill his older brother that in an effort to do so, he got himself killed and assured that even though his army had won the battle, he personally lost, and Artaxerxes very shortly reasserted control and proclaimed a meeting with the generals of the Greek mercenary troops, in which he killed them, leaving second-tier officers, among them Xenophon, to lead the mercenary troops out back to Greece, which is the primary subject of Xenophon's anabasis, and which, with some difficulty, the leaders of the mercenary band succeeded in doing. Meanwhile, complicated tale, Agesilaus had come to Anatolia, to what is now Turkey, in hopes, as the Spartans put it, of liberating the Greeks in Asia, which since the time of the Ionian Wars a century before, the Ionian Revolt a century before, had been a long-standing Persian goal. When he got to the Aegean shore of Turkey, however, the Ionian world, Agesilaus very quickly discovered that the big man there was Lysander. And all of the folks who wanted favors and so forth talked to Lysander and not to him. And even though Lysander had been his lover, even though Lysander had been instrumental in securing the throne for him, Agesilaus found this situation intolerable and very effectively cut away Lysander's power base. First of all, by refusing the requests of anyone who he became aware had spoken with Lysander first about them. Talk to Lysander and you don't get what you want, rather than talk to Lysander and you do. And finally, to make the point absolutely unmistakable, he assigned Lysander the less than terribly prestigious role of personal carver for King Agesilaus at the dinner table. Lysander finally got the message, said, "I understand. You certainly know how to humiliate somebody, Agesilaus. Send me where you think I can be of use, preferably not around here." Which, in fact, Agesilaus very, very soon did. It's an interesting story. Not very often in politics does one see a kingmaker deposed successfully by the king whom the kingmaker makes, so to speak. But here, Agesilaus handled it smoothly and didn't even make Lysander so furious with him that Lysander tried to assassinate him. He pulled it off. And well that he did, Lysander was a capable commander, but the Persians, meanwhile, were playing an interesting game. Up to this time, it had been the Athenians who had been most interested in, by and large, liberating the Ionian Greeks and operations against the Persian Empire. Now the Spartans had taken on that role. And so what the Persians began to do was to subsidize massively, not Spartan naval power, as they had done during the latter phases of the Peloponnesian War, but an alliance of Athens, Argos, Thebes and Boeotia, and Corinth even, Sparta's long-term ally, against Sparta. So suddenly, Agesilaus, uniquely at this point, ever in Spartan history, to the best of my knowledge, commander of Sparta's land forces and naval forces over in what is now Turkey, found himself fighting a two-front war, not only against the Persians, but also against this powerful league of essentially every other powerful, more or less first-rate polis in Greece. That's where he sent Lysander, and indeed, Lysander was killed at a battle in Boeotia, at a place called Haliartus, just a year later. Persia, in other words, was playing a very clever and indeed very effective game of divide and conquer, using its own troops and its own military resources as little as possible, but instead subsidizing whichever side seemed to be losing in the ongoing conflict between Sparta and Athens and her other Greek rivals. Well, one result of this was in 394, the Spartan ephors, even though Agesilaus was doing very well and had been campaigning successfully in Asia Minor, Turkey, Ionia, they recalled him to Sparta, recalled him home to take control of the Spartan effort nearer the home front against the allies, Athens, Corinth, Boeotia, Argos, and others in what came to be called the Corinthian War. And sure enough, in 394, when he came home, he won a pair of victories, one at Nemea, relatively near Corinth, and another tight one, but more decisive one, in Coronea and Boeotia. So Sparta begins to move ahead to some degree once again. Meanwhile, Lysander's house was searched, and Agesilaus claimed, and by and large, as far as I can tell, historians believe him, he found, or his minions found, in Lysander's home in Sparta, a scroll outlining Lysander's proposal to make the Spartan kingship non-hereditary, save that a king of Sparta would have to be one of the Heraclids, a descendant of the Spartan royal family in the widest sense. In other words, Lysander had been at least exploring the idea of fomenting a revolution of sorts, as a result of which Lysander himself would be able to stand for the position as king and would presumably achieve it. He had, while he was in Ionia, achieved honors which no Greek before him is on record of having achieved, and accepted them, which did not go over well with the Spartans. The people in the island of Samos, which had long-standing connections with Sparta in particular, had literally worshipped him as a living god, and indeed had gone so far as to redesignate their local annual festival in honor of Hera, the Lysandria, in honor of Lysander himself as a living god. So certainly Lysander had demonstrated the capacity to generate and achieve substantial power. But as after his death, the Spartan authorities inquired closely into his affairs, they discovered to their amazement that even though he had, at the peak of his power, been the most influential Greek of all, he died poor. He was not ambitious for money, curiously enough, at all, evidently. Ambitious only for power, prestige, and influence. He was so poor, in fact, that several suitors who at that time had wished to marry his daughters withdrew their suit, and the Spartan authorities fined them disgustedly for seeking to marry money rather than virtue. He was that poor. In any case, now things turned in favor of the Spartans more substantially. They were able to rebuild their fleet under the leadership now of a person by the name of Antalcidas, or Antalcidas, and once again, about 388, 387, they achieved one of the enduring goals of Spartan foreign policy when it was directed against Athens, and that is they gained control of the Hellespont and were able to choke off Athens' grain supplies, which put Athens as well and the Corinthian League, of which Athens was a major part as well, into a negotiating frame of mind. And the result in 386 was the Peace of Antalcidas, or alternatively, this is who really benefited most decisively, the King's Peace, that is to say, the Peace of Artaxerxes, the King of Persia. And the upshot was that both Athens and Sparta finally gave up efforts to liberate or remove from Persian control the Greeks who lived in western Turkey or Ionia. At this point, as in 404, at the conclusion of the Peloponnesian War, Sparta was riding very high indeed, under no immediate threat from Persia as a result of the King's Peace or the Peace of Antalcidas, and dominant after the Corinthian War, to some substantial degree at least, over every other polis effectively in at least the southern Greek world. In 382, 4 years later, in fact, Sparta occupied the Kadmia, the small acropolis or central citadel of Thebes, who had been one of the leaders in the Corinthian War against Sparta, so named the Cadmea for Cadmus, the mythical founder of Thebes, a millennium plus beforehand. And the Spartans installed as harmost, to use the Spartan term, or overseer of Thebes, in the Spartan interest, a man by the name of Sphodrius. Sphodrius, however, overstepped his charge in a way which was ultimately to prove, as things gradually began to spiral out of control, disastrous for Sparta. He, on his own initiative, decided that Sparta, not only dominating Thebes, and he in person as Harmost doing much of the dominating, it would also be very nice if Sparta could dominate Athens as well. So on his own initiative, he launched a covert strike against the main Athenian port area of the Piraeus. And if you controlled the Piraeus, you could starve Athens. This, if he succeeded, would be a major power play on the part of Sparta. But he had no authorization from the Spartan authorities to try this. He did it entirely on his own initiative, and he failed miserably in his attempt and succeeded in annoying the Athenians, understandably, way, way, way past endurance. When he had failed, Sphodrius declined to come back to Sparta, knowing correctly, or anticipating correctly, that he would be tried for treason for pulling this stunt, and very likely sentenced to death as a result of it. But, and this is one of the instances where it would seem that Agesilaus showed poor judgment. Agesilaus, not wanting to lose a full Spartan, of whom there were fewer and fewer, who, if nothing else, showed initiative, engineered the trial so that he was exonerated. This, as you might imagine, annoyed the Athenians even more. They were, even at the time, harboring disaffected Theban exiles, and in a coup of almost farcical unlikeliness, a group of Thebans, led by a man named Pelopidas, in the winter of 379-78, succeeded in deposing the Spartan garrison and regaining control of Thebes for the Thebans, who by this time, along with the Athenians, were likewise very, very annoyed with the Spartans. Unfortunately for the Spartans, very unfortunately for the Spartans, as we shall see, Pelopidas was a commander of genius, and his counterpart and partner in Thebes, Epaminondas, was at least arguably, with the possible exception of Alexander, the most brilliant general that ancient Greece ever produced. Sparta had, to put the matter in metaphorical terms, kicked the wrong beehive. There was real trouble brewing. One thing that happened in the immediate aftermath was the foundation of a second Theban confederacy. Thebes traditionally had led an alliance of allied states or poles, showing greater or lesser degrees of enthusiasm, in Boeotia, and the Theban confederacy in the past, and now, even at this moment, became a powerful military presence. Meanwhile, the Athenians, who were equally annoyed, founded a second Athenian league, predominantly naval, and Pelopidas founded in Thebes what was to become one of the most famous and effective military units in antiquity, the so-called Theban Sacred Band. And the Theban Sacred Band was an absolutely elite corps of 150 pairs of homosexual lovers. The idea being, assuming, as was accurate in this instance, that the men involved were practiced and effective warriors to begin with, fighting with their lovers, they would die happily rather endure the least whisper of disgrace or diminishment of reputation. And so indeed, in the event, it turned out the Sacred Band proved to be very effective indeed, as long as it existed. Thebes soon enough began to feel its oats. At the Battle of Tegira, or Tegira, in 375, the Sacred Band defeated, not anything resembling a full Spartan call-out, but a genuine homoioi, or Spartan crack troop detachment. In the first time the Spartans had lost a stand-up infantry battle, Sphacteria in the Peloponnesian War being something quite different from that, basically in 300 years. This suggested that the Thebans were doing pretty well, and the Sacred Band was doing pretty well in particular. And in fact, Antalcidas, the Spartan admiral, is on record as saying to Agesilaus, the Spartan king, you know, you should really quit fighting these Thebans so often, no matter how much you dislike them and everything they stand for, which in the case of Agesilaus was about infinitely. Because what you are doing, contrary to traditional Spartan custom, is you are giving them an ongoing graduate-level course, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, in military tactics. Every time we fight them, they're getting better. Are you sure this is a good idea? Well, the next battle, a very major battle, was a crushing, jaw-dropping, Hellenic world-changing defeat for Sparta, which effectively marked the end of Sparta's career as a great power. The Battle of Leuctra in Thebes. At this point, there were only a bit more than 1,000 full Spartans left for a variety of reasons, which are worth attending to in some detail. For the past 200 years, Sparta had increasingly had difficulties maintaining the number of its full citizens. From a peak of 8,000 or 9,000, the number of full citizens had declined to slightly over 1,000, which is one reason that in the Peloponnesian War, Brasidas had used freed helots, the Brasidoi or Neodamidois, one reason that Sparta had increasingly been employing perioikic hoplites, that is, hoplites who were not full citizens, but not Spartans either, from surrounding towns in their battle line. There were just fewer and fewer Spartans around. Well, at Leuctra, of the 700 of the 1,000-odd Spartans alive at the time, 400 were killed in an afternoon. Monumental casualties. They ran up in Epaminondas against a commander of real genius. At Leuctra, he made several moves which wrong-footed the Spartans badly. For one thing, traditionally, hoplite battle lines had been ranged 8 deep, ideally. Epaminondas ranged one side of the Theban battle line, not 8 deep, but 50 deep, approached the Spartans at an angle rather than head-on, was effectively able to turn their flank and essentially and crushingly destroyed them. That morning, Sparta was the dominant power in Greece. That afternoon, Thebes was the dominant power in Greece, and Sparta's run, centuries long, of Hellenic dominance was over. The Spartans, of course, didn't realize that immediately and contested the result for a good while, but they never succeeded in achieving anything even very much like their previous dominance. As it happens, Xenophon, the Athenian, who had served with Sparta, in fact, both in the expedition on behalf of Cyrus to Persia and later on in the Corinthian War, was apparently at Sparta when the news came to Sparta of the crushing defeat at Leuctra. This is his report, perhaps very likely an eyewitness report, certainly a report from testimony from eyewitnesses. It was on the last day of the Gymnopedia festival that the messenger sent to report the catastrophe arrived at Sparta. The Gymnopedia festival, you'll remember, was one of the three major summer festivals of Sparta and was something which they took very seriously. One reason, I presume, that 500 or so of the Spartan citizens were not at Leuctra, but were in fact at Sparta. The men's chorus was in the theater at the time. When the ephors heard what had happened, they were deeply grieved, as indeed they were bound to be. Yet instead of closing the performance, I suspect, interjecting parenthetically, that they had more than a suspicion of what this meant for Spartan power, that the end had in fact come. They allowed the chorus to continue to the end. When they gave the names of all the dead to the respective relatives, roughly one-third of the citizens in Sparta, they instructed the women to bear their suffering in silence and to stifle any cries of lamentation. On the following day, you could see those women whose relatives had been killed going about looking bright and cheerful, whereas those whose relatives had been reported as still alive were not much in evidence, and those few who were out and about were looking gloomy and sorry for themselves. Well, what that suggests is at this point, Sparta had most certainly and most severely been defeated in a military sense, but on the home front, at least, the Spartan ethos still held. Nevertheless, there were enough disgraced Spartan survivors of Leuctra who had, in some sense, proved themselves, to use the Spartan term, tremblers or cowards, who by Spartan law were to be brutally shunned. There were enough of them that Agesilaus, when they returned home, the surviving king of Sparta, was presented with a real problem: how to deal with this very substantial body of men approaching half the surviving full Spartan citizens who had disgraced themselves. And what he did is interesting. he proclaimed. The loss of Sparta remained the loss of Sparta. However, for one day only, today, they will be taking a vacation. And he readmitted the disgraced Spartans, and Sparta continued on its way. Never again, however, to regain the power which it had previously enjoyed.
This ends Lecture 13.